You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and this week's show continues this month's strand of masculinity in American comics. My guest this week is Howard Chaykin, a writer and artist who has been working in comics since the 1970s and put his indelible stamp on a variety of characters from science fiction, film, and the comic book world. Over the past three decades, Howard has been published by a variety of different publishers, from indie titles to mainstream comics. And we're going to be talking about some of his creator-owned projects, as well as superhero and sci-fi comics that he did for various publishers. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the programme makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. Resonance FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I got into your work quite late as a fan of comics. It was when you started drawing Wolverine and Blade. And the thing that grabbed me right away was that the way that you depict these characters is a lot more honest than other people. You're not worried at all about depicting people like Wolverine, who would obviously actually be quite an ugly, squat character in real life, as that on the page. And because of that honesty and the dynamism of the way that you construct a page, I found your version of Wolverine one of the best that I'd read in a long time.
That's very kind. Thank you.
No worries. Was coming back to Marvel Comics something that you'd been wanting to do for a while, or was it the project that suggested to you that maybe you were the right man for the job?
Well, it's odd because I had not been aware. It's a short question for a long answer for a short question. I had not really been aware of what Marvel had become and evolved into as a company over the past couple of years because I had not been really paying that much attention to comics. So when I was approached by Marvel to come over and do Blade, when I read the proposal, my first instinct was to say no because I'm not really a fan of that sort of material. But when I read the proposal, I was blown away by it. I thought it was really smart. I thought it was clever. I thought it was funny. And I became reacquainted with the material. And I realized that the company had transformed enormously under Joe. And that the material that they were producing was, you know, kind of interesting, fascinating, and very much the sort of work I felt I could do. I had never felt capable of doing the kind of work they were seeking, if that makes any sense.
Hmm. Because these days they've got greater appreciation of a wider range of artists rather than, say, a Marvel House style.
Yes, but I mean, bear in mind, when I was a kid in the 70s, that was really the tone of the material. And that is no longer the case, and that's a really exciting aspect of the material.
I then, because I'm working my way kind of backwards through your career, I picked up the Challenges of the Unknown trade because I'd come across the characters in other versions. And again, I found it quite a really interesting comic because, A, it's your use of dynamic panels and rendering people in quite a sort of realistic, stroke ugly way, and also the politics of the piece, which I found really interesting for a comic of that time.
Well, I expected the book to cause more of a ripple than it did. It seemed to be functionally ignored, except by at least one guy on the internet who referred to me as, quote, a left-wing faggot. And, you know, I accept, you know, the realities of how the comic book business adjusts itself. I had a pretty good time with Challengers. I was very happy with it. And I'm surprised it didn't get more attention or annoy more people. I'm frankly very surprised about that.
Because it does seem to be very much combining your two main interests, a sort of a sci-fi look at the present day and gung-ho action heroes who are well-armed and, you know, take no prisoners.
Yeah, but I'd say that's fairly true.
Again, were Challengers the Unknown characters that you'd been interested in before that you thought could do with a revamp?
No, actually, I was approached by Dan DiDio in that regard. He simply asked me if I'd be interested in doing it, and it seemed like a fun gig. He wanted to basically reboot the title, and that's what I did. No apparent effect, apparently.
Because around the same time, you'd been writing various comics for Vertigo, American Century, and
yes.
Was Mighty Love published by them as well?
Yes. No, Mighty Love was DC.
Okay.
And presumably they were creator-owned projects.
Yes.
That sort of freedom of doing a creator-owned project, but for a mainstream company that presumably has a greater advertising budget than the smaller companies, was that something you'd been looking for?
I have to say that I tend to approach everything I do with the same level of commitment.
Mm.
I don't have a sliding scale for what is and what isn't acceptable on for any one client. It really is a matter of, for my money, delivering a consistent product. Because, I mean, to use a hackneyed phrase, I consider myself a brand. And that when someone goes into business with me, they can pretty much figure out within certain parameters what they can expect from me. And I believe that's where my consistency lays, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, you know, looking at I've got the challenges of the unknown trade in front of me, and your name is as big a type as the title of the comic, so it's as much appealing to your fans as fans of the characters.
I would think it's. I mean, if you're a fan of the challenge of the unknown, you may be interested. I think it's more likely that it's, you know, you're someone who's interested in seeing my take on the material would be likely to pick it up. I mean, I've been very flattered by some of the reaction to the book. I kind of wish it had sold better, but I've heard very nice things about the book, and again, I feel it's work I'm proud of having done.
Hmm. When did you think that you had started to become a brand, that people were following you rather than the titles that you were doing?
I think around the time that I did Black Kiss.
Hmm.
That makes the most sense. I think that really is it. For better or worse, I was perceived as a guy who did sex and violence with a certain broad stroke humor. Because I do like, I mean, I'm a great believer in it, that for material to have any real impact on me, it has to have some laughs in it as well. I believe that it's all about thrills, chills, and laughs. And I embrace all those things.
Well, apparently it was shipped in an adults-only plastic bag. Was that a surprise
to you? Yes, my kiss was disgusting.
Okay.
It was excoriated and then but became fairly successful. So I'm delighted that it was excoriated. I was described at the time as writing, and I'm paraphrasing here, public transportation dialogue. And I think it was a damning me with faint praise. And I prefer to think of it as praising me with faint damn. I like the idea that I don't write dialogue that sounds as if it's a pontification from superheroes or heroes of any kind. I like to write dialogue that sounds like it's actually spoken.
Mm. Well, that's what I was getting at earlier, the honesty in your work, was that, you know, you read comics and so much of it doesn't sound like real dialogue, and the characters are just almost too pretty in a way.
Right, exactly. I know exactly what you mean.
And in a way, that kind of exemplifies both what typifies your work in a way and also what typifies a lot of superhero comics is the implicit homoeroticism of it. That an awful lot of superhero comics are men in tights beating each other up, and if that's not, you know, a metaphor for something, I don't know. And then in your characters, the men are very manly, and, you know, you aren't afraid to draw muscly characters, hairy characters, that perhaps have a wider appeal than these slightly effete men in tights that inhabit so many other comics.
Well, I think what you're reading as effete, I'm going to try not to be insulting to my colleagues. I think what you're talking about is self-idealization.
Mm.
You know, years and years ago, I mean many years ago, 25 years ago, I went to a cocktail party when I still lived in New York City, and I was in a room full of guys who made their living drawing perfect physical specimens, and they were all sort of fat slobs. And that was when I realized that I had to start joining the gym and actually start exercising, you know, because it just seemed ridiculous. And I realized that a lot of guys in the comic book business tend to create idealized images of perfect manhood, not out of any homoeroticism, but out of a self-involved wish dream. It's easier to draw those things than actually become those things. It's kind of like, you know, studio executives in Hollywood. I remember the first time I wrote a movie, the first note I got was, can I make these characters more idealistic, more altruistic? And these notes were coming from people who were criminals. There's a lot to be said for the idea that comic book talent tends to do idealized versions of what they'd like to be themselves, if only they'd be willing to do the work.
Mm.
And does that make any sense?
Yes, no, definitely. I mean, you know, the whole wish fulfillment thing, I think, is actually appealing to what they believe an awful lot of the comic book audience is you know, bullied mm-hmm. teens who are looking for characters that they can live out their fantasies through.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not being too cruel. Another strand in your work that I find very interesting, I think that there was right there from the start, is perhaps an interest in graphic design. Now, you know, I recently, today, read the first issue of American Flag. It's the way that you lay out the page using the noise of ammunition, the noise of people speaking out of speakers and microphones, as a way of dividing up the page through repetitive text that I, again, haven't seen very often in comics. And so was typography and the use of typography in comics something that you thought could be expanded upon when you first started doing it? Because I guess
Absolutely.
A lot of it is very bland.
The problem is that lettering has now become an in-house discipline, so that it's difficult to achieve those kind of effects with the interchangeability of the lettering function. When I do outside work, when I have the opportunity to do so, I engage a specific letterer, in this case mostly frequently the work of Ken Brusenak, because it's an opportunity to employ the typography in line with the color and the text to create a total package. And I really like that totality of package.
Because you also, you shared a studio in the early 80s, Rubber Writing Thinking, with Frank Miller and Walt Simonson?
Yes.
And in terms of looking at the three styles that came out of that studio, there seemed to be a little bit of crossover there, with perhaps the angular use of lines, the more dramatic use of shading than compared to other comics at the time. Did you bounce ideas
off
each other?
Well, I mean, I've definitely been influenced by Walter. I don't think there's been any cross-influence between me or Frank or Walter and Frank. I don't see any of that. But I've never denied the fact that Walter was a profound influence on me. But, I think Walter is a brilliant artist, one of the great unsung. Well, I mean, I think he's sung enough, but you know, I think it's a wonderful talent, one of the best artists in comics ever.
But certainly sharing a studio with those two, what was that experience like? Did you share art with each other and get feedback?
No, not really. We worked at we had a large studio. We worked at four corners of the studio, and we lived separate lives and you know and worked each other. But you know, Walter and I were fairly close. We were good friends. And we socialized outside of the office, as I did with Frank and his girlfriend at the time. But we worked pretty much alone.
Okay.
We all had our various responsibilities.
Because thematically, I can see similarities between your work and Frank's. The ultra-masculine male characters, the slightly more idealized females that are sort of the driving force of many plots, the ultra-violence and so on. But maybe because you started sharing a studio because of similar interests and not as some sort of product of working together.
I think what it comes down to is we all come from the same roots. We're all, you know, we all come out of the pulps. It's really how the work is executed that matters in the long run.
Sure. Because another one of your interests is science fiction.
You know, less so than you'd think.
Really? Because, I mean, you know...
the fact of the matter is, I don't read science fiction. I haven't read SF in 35 years.
Wow.
I have no idea what's going on in the current science fiction community, with the very specific exception of a guy named S.M. Sterling, who I continue to read. But I'm very unhip to what's happening in SF. I use science fiction as a jumping-off point in some of my work, but for the most part, I'm much more interested in crime fiction, both as a reader and as a producer.
Okay.
I have no idea who the hot tickets are in SF right now, but I can tell you who I know and love in the world of crime fiction and thrillers.
Okay. So, because your work in the 70s, though, were adaptations of Fritz Leiber, Michael Moorcock,
yes.
Sam Delaney.
And I acknowledge that Leiber was a huge influence on me, as was Michael Moorcock. But the fact of the matter is, I no longer read that stuff, and you're talking about work that I did when I was 25.
Yeah. So it was
I'm
phase.
I'm not 25.
No, I get that.
I mean, one of the things about the internet and Wikipedia is I can no longer lie about my age, so it's easy to find out. You know, I'm 59 years old, and, you know, I've got a track record that goes back to 1971. So we're talking about, you know, a long career. And a career that I continue, I hope to continue, as a matter of fact.
Well, I hope so, too.
So yeah, my tastes have changed, evolved, devolved, depending on how you look at it. And so I look at different things, and I enjoy different things.
So would it be safe to say, then, you did quite a lot of sci-fi in the 70s, but then got it out of your system in a way and moved into crime as a new love.
I think that's fair, yeah.
Which crime authors would you say influenced you then?
Influenced me?
Yeah.
I mean, no, I mean, I'm influenced by everything I read. But, you know, I mean, I started with... Archie Goodwin is the guy who weaned us away from crime, from science fiction into crime.
Okay.
He was the one who got us into Hammett and Chandler and McDonald's, both McDonald's, although I'm not a big fan of either. And Rex Stout and the Nero Wolfe stuff. Mm. And then that led, of course, to more contemporary guys. I mean, these days I read, you know, everybody from Lee Child to Thomas Perry to Stephen Hunter to Dennis Lehane, George Pelicanos, James Ellroy, just the guys, you know, the modern guys. I mean, I'm not a fan of Spillane. It's something I've never been able to read the material. Maybe it's the politics, maybe it's just the crudeness of it. I've never been a fan. I like Mickey personally, and a couple of times I met him, but the work has never interested me.
But the kind of crime fiction that does interest you, I guess it's the themes of corrupted heroism that seems to be something that's prevalent in a lot of your work.
I don't know about corrupt. I think it's less the... I mean, I think I tend to do heroes who have feet of clay, who are forced by circumstance, who... Yeah, I just read an essay by Lee Child, for example, about his character, Jack Reacher. And he talks about the character's arrogance, which I really find... it's one of the things I find most appealing about the character. And the smarty pantsness of the character, besides the fact that he weighs 250 pounds and is 6'5". And I kind of like that. I like a character who's occasionally smug and gets knocked off his high horse now and then, but keeps getting back on. Mm. There's all sorts of fun you can have with characters who are, you know, let's face it, comic book characters have the same basic damages, the wound. The show business term for that over the past couple of years has been, what is this character's wound? And, you know, all these characters have their wounds. And I kind of prefer the idea of a character whose wound is more psychological and interesting than revenge or, you know, a bad day when you were a kid and things like that. It's just all sorts of stuff that can be done.
I mean, over the last decade, you've done as much writing as you have drawing comics.
Yes.
Was that frustration with the kind of scripts that you're reading by the people and were being offered to you as
artists?
Not
really. No, I mean, I write and draw for myself. I write for others, and I draw other people's scripts. I mean, let's face it. On the Wolverine stuff, I drew other people's work. I had a great time working with Jason and Mark. On the Blade stuff, I had a great time working with Mark. On the Punisher stuff, I had a wonderful time working with Matt Fraction and Rick Remender. I've been very lucky to work with writers whose work I really love. And by the same token, to draw stuff for guys who do some bitching stuff.
And looking at artists that are coming up, when you chose other artists to illustrate the scripts that you'd written, were you looking for styles that were completely different to your own, so that in a way it was a different kind of fusion between what you were writing and what was produced on the page?
No, it isn't really a matter of choosing. Very often we are assigned together. You know, it's not as if I operate from this perspective of coming down from the mountain and pointing at an artist and saying, you are mine. That doesn't play. You know, I'm a journeyman guy. I mean, I have a long career, but, you know, I'm a cult figure. You know, I'm not a star per se. I'm more the Robert Altman of comics. I'm more the Van Morrison of comics than I am, say, the Bruce Springsteen or the Steven Spielberg, if you will. And that makes me more of a cult figure, and thus gives me a certain range to play in, but it also means that, you know, I'm frequently teamed up with people who may not be my first choice, but I have, as I say, been lucky in that regard.
Although looking at your work, I think you'd rather be Robert Altman than Steven Spielberg.
Actually, I'd rather be able to make my living sitting on my fat ass eating macaroni and cheese and never leaving the house.
Okay.
but since that option doesn't exist, I have to work.
You said that you enjoyed the takes on the characters of Blade and Wolverine that were offered to
you. Yes,
I
did.
Most recently, you've been writing a Die Hard origin comic.
Yes, I'm actually having a fabulous time doing it. I'm starting the 7th issue script today.
Cool. How did that first come about? Were you talking to Boom about various projects, or were they intended to do?
No, Ross Ritchie came to me and said, hi, would you like to write this? And he said, we'd like to do a 70s book. It's a prequel and all this other. He gave me all this stuff. And I said, sure, because it was an interesting assignment. It was something a little offbeat. And it gave me an opportunity to use all of my own anecdotal experiences in the 1970s, because that's when I came of age.
Okay.
And The first arc, if you've seen it, takes place during the bicentennial weekend, and the second arc takes place during the blackout, and it's a lot of fun to write. It really is. And apparently, everybody seems to be very happy with it.
Presumably, you've seen the films. You didn't have to reinvent.
Yeah, I have seen the films. Yes,
but not read the novels by Roderick Thorpe.
I've read the novels.
Because there is obviously quite a difference between the way.
Oh yes, I'm doing the John McClane of the movie, not the novels by any means. Trust me on it.
But are you?
That's the character the world knows.
Because though that the novels are set in the 60s, presumably in 70s.
Yeah, oh, I know. As I say, I've read the novels. What we're doing is we're seeing John McClane as in the first arc as a young uniformed patrolman. Hmm. And in the second arc as a first-year detective.
But what I was getting at was, do you find the novel to help, or are you paving...
Not at all. The character I'm doing is the John McClane character portrayed by Bruce Willis in the movies. I mean, if you remember from the novel, it's not his wife that is at the company, but his daughter, and that there's no rapprochement, and it's a lot bloodier.
But it's interesting, it must be interesting as a writer, the way that different characters evolve and appear in different mythologies in a way. Because, for example, you've put your own version of Wolverine and Blade out there, and now this is your version of Die Hard, which in its way...
I don't think it was my version of Wolverine or Blade. I think what it comes down to is that I was hired to be part of a train. Mm. I mean, when you work on a job, on a character that's being done by other people, and you're working in the same sort of arc with them, what your job really is to maintain a level of continuity. Mm. And I followed the continuity that existed before mine, and I'm assuming others followed me as they followed me after my arc. So I really kind of feel that my job is to maintain the efficiency of the train, if that makes any sense.
But at the same time, bring some freshness to it.
Oh, absolutely. No question. I mean, I'm not simply mocking and aping what's previously. For example, I mean, the arc that I did featured sequences that took place during World War I, okay? And the setup for that sequence had been done a couple of issues earlier by another artist who drew Wolverine in a flashback, brief flashback, wearing a Tommy helmet, one of the tin helmets that the Americans and the English wore. But the Canadians didn't wear those helmets at the time than the story took place. Rather, they were actually wearing field caps. But I was constrained by the previously established image to stay with what had been set up. So I did. Mm. You know, I did not do what the Canadian uniform... The uniform I drew was a pastiche of the American and British uniform, if that makes any sense.
Well, I suppose you could excuse it as that's what the uniforms look like in the Marvel Universe.
No, I think you can excuse it on the fact that the artist didn't know any better and just drew what he thought of.
When it came to doing Die Hard then, set in the 1970s, did you do any additional research in terms of...
I frankly only had to do some reminding me research because, frankly, I lived through this time.
Okay.
I mean, much of the anecdote of the bicentennial stuff, I mean, it's obviously a fantastical plot, but much of the events of the day, I mean, I was there. And much of the events of the blackout are experiences that I had because I was there. I mean, I spent the night of the 1970s blackout with Alan Weiss, who's another cartoonist. And we had a great time because it was a drunken frenzy.
Excellent. The covers of Die Hard are quite startling as well, particularly the ones...
No question. I mean, those guys are doing phenomenal work, aren't they?
Did you...
I love John Paul Leon. I love what Jock is doing, but I'm going to have to say it right here and now. Dave Johnson is my favorite cover artist in the comic book business, period.
Okay.
He's the greatest.
Did you have any...
Fantastic.
I was just going to say that Jock's one in particular actually reminds me of some of your covers of Challengers of the Unknown, the way that it's...
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Very right.
Stark. Dave Johnson, man. The guy is just fantastic.
But I was talking about the great expanses of space, the jaunty angles for the text... The fact that they stick out on the stands very much compared to other titles. Did you have any say at all in the design, or were you actually just surprised
not in the
when
lead.
They came in?
Nope. I'm a hired gun writing the book. I get to like them as much as everybody else does.
Okay.
That's the great part of it. I just get to like them.
So as someone who has done comics that have been completely designed by you, the cover, the text, the script and the art. Is it quite nice in a way to write a script and then just send it out and look forward to how it's going to be when it comes back to you?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And then, of course, you also bitch and moan about, the, oh, he didn't get this, he didn't get that, he got, oh, but that's interesting. Wow, that's really cool. So there's all sorts of different reactions, responses, and actions.
And I suppose the longer that you work with the same artist, you start a relationship and a dialogue with them that you can feed off each other's strengths.
In some cases, that's true.
When it comes to future projects that you're working on, can we expect more comics that you're writing and drawing at the same time?
Yes, unequivocally. I just finished the script for a miniseries I'm drawing and writing, and I'm also in the process of doing artwork on a miniseries that I'm not writing, but drawing.
Okay. Any particular genres? Or are you sworn to secrecy?
One's a superhero thing. The other is a period piece. And I'm also, of course, continuing to do the Cobra sequences for Hearts and Minds for IDW.
Okay. So keeping a variety of different genres and projects on your desk at
always.
Any one time, presumably the difference of different projects that come up, in a way it keeps you flexible as an artist because you have to flex different muscles, as it were, from one project to the next.
Well, what it does really is it makes my studio a complete mess. Because I've got one pile of reference for this and another pile of reference for that, and since I'm working on everything all at one time, everything is just, I've got piles and piles of junk. Because I don't fake anything. I mean, I'm a great believer in reference and pictures. Mm. And so my office is always, it's always one pile of reference being used and being segued out to be replaced by the next pile. And that's the nature of my beast.
And no unexpected bleeds from one project into another.
Oh, that occasionally happens. There's no way to escape that. You know, I'll frequently find that I'm working on a period piece that sketches an attitude that works perfectly for this. Things all blur together. Absolutely.
And do you keep abreast of advances in, say, graphic design outside of the industry?
I do. I try to. I regret the fact that I don't have the amount of time I'd like to have to basically spend more time in tutorial. Because there's so many things I need to learn to do that I feel like I'm not up to speed on as much as I'd like to be.
Well, I suppose that is the curse of the artist, is in a way.
Well, I think if I were drawing a huge paycheck that I could afford to sit back and learn it, I'd love to. You know, but unfortunately I'm like a mop. I'm like, it's like the Sopranos. You know, you're not working, you're not earning. You know.
Cool.
One of Howard's most famous comics, American Flag, has just been published in two definitive omnibus editions. And the latest issue of his Die Hard Year One comic, Issue 4, is available today in all good comic shops. You can find more info about Howard's comics on our blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.